Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Well, another very busy week, certainly in current affairs, but in politics. And I think there's a couple of issues that we really need to address because they are developing almost every day, Nazir.
It's so noisy. There's so much noise, whether it's royal families or whether it's politics or whether it's high-profile cases. They all seem to be reaching a crescendo right now, aren't they? And I'm absolutely delighted that our listeners want to know more, and we'll hopefully be able to share some of our experiences with them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we're getting feedback from is people want us to discuss the events that are occurring in the news on a day-to-day basis. And they want us to unpick them a little bit more, talk in a little bit more detail and give our thoughts around that. And of course, one of the subjects that we have covered quite extensively is that of Prince Andrew. Now, there was a major development this week, actually against what I thought was likely to happen, only simply because I thought that this was going to run to a trial because the victim didn't want it in any other way, wanted to hear that evidence in a trial process. But of course, Prince Andrew never wanted it to go that far because the risks involved in that are massive and considerable. Why do you think it is that both parties have decided at the moment, in principle, to settle?
Well, I think two things. One, the sum of money that we are hearing that Prince Andrew is prepared to, not prepared to, that has to pay, you know, £12 million or more, is, I can't imagine that a judge would give any more than that. I mean, if you remember when Virginia Giuffre settled in effect in relation to Epstein, the sum of money was £500,000. So, we're talking into ridiculous sums of money, which I think would have been played on her mind. You know, what's the point of going all the way when actually I'm being offered, or certainly my charities, because she's giving it to her victims' charities, are being offered, you know, 24 times or more what Jeffrey Epstein was prepared to pay. I think that's number one. Number two, it's evident that a lot of pressure has been put on Prince Andrew. I think something that it was reported that Prince Charles, for example, has been putting pressure on him to settle. And you know, the last thing they wanted, as we all knew, was that they didn't want any of this being aired in public in a courtroom. So I think adding those two things together, they had to come to this resolution. It is unsatisfactory from a victim's perspective because, you know, I imagine I know for a fact that lots of victims' groups and others have said that they wanted this case to go all the way so that they would highlight and raise awareness of sex offending and sex trafficking. But at the same time, she's been immensely courageous in standing up to the establishment in the way that she has. And I think that, as I said, you know, the amount of money that was being offered to settle this was considerably more than I imagine she would have got after a trial.
And I think we need to unpick some of these aspects because it does bring about, for me, quite a lot of questions. I think the first important thing to consider is this, of course, was not a criminal trial. It was a civil case. And therefore, the outcome are very different in respect of criminal to civil. Certainly in relation to financial settlement. You know, that was one big element of the civil process. Of course, that's not a outcome for a criminal trial.
No.
It's not about money. But it's a weighing up with regards to if the end outcome of a civil trial is a large financial settlement and you can get that financial settlement without going to trial, then, of course, it's a win, isn't it? You see,
yes.
Okay, there's a benefit there. The question that sits behind that is, where is that acceptance? If a large sum of money is paid, and that large sum of money is paid on the basis of fully accepting the allegations that are made, that's one thing. But it's another thing if that large sum of money is paid, but the individual paying the money doesn't accept the allegations that are being made. Now, it does raise a question, why on earth are you going to pay somebody such a large sum of money if what you're saying, if you don't say what they're saying is true?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, he's not going to accept liability. I mean, there is no incentive to him to pay £12 million or more. And then at the same time say, yes, I'm totally responsible. If you read the statement that was issued by his lawyers, or by the lawyers of both teams, in effect, he accepts the pain that he has caused Virginia Giuffre by his tactics, you know, the fact that he pursued all these various technicalities, the victim blaming that was going on, the fact that, you know, she has suffered not only from him, but also that others piled on, in effect. So there's an element of that. He also talks about his relationship with Epstein, and how he used the words, regrets his relationship with Epstein. Again, begs belief, doesn't it, really? You know, he regrets his relationship with one convicted sex trafficker. He doesn't mention the other one, Ghislaine Maxwell. I'm sure we'll touch on in a moment, actually, because there's been an update in relation to that. So he, you know, he goes as far as he can without accepting liability. But yeah, the court of public opinion is quite important here, isn't it, Mark? Because everybody's been saying the same thing. His defense is, I never met her. Don't know who she is. I was in Pizza Express in Woking at the purported time. The photograph is not genuine, but here's £12 million. I mean,
utter denial. Don't know the lady, never met her, wasn't there at the time of the alleged allegations, but I'm prepared to pay you £12 million, not £12, £12 million.
Yeah,
and this is being paid to someone who he says is saying things that aren't true.
Exactly.
And however you look at it, you have to say there is no way you're going to pay £12 million to somebody who is making something up, who is basically unknown to you. I mean, it's such a mad process, this whole legal setup around making a payment but not accepting liability in any way. It begs the question, you go, what is the point in having that? Because any common sense attitude and approach to this, and even Prince Andrew himself, I'm sure, can't think to himself that the general members of the public will forever consider him having made this payment as responsible.
Oh, exactly. I mean, people have made up their own minds, and they will have now, I suspect, more evidence in their minds anyway, to be able to say whether or not this allegation was true or not. For all the reasons you've just identified, it seems, you know, it seemed a lot of money for something you didn't do in relation to somebody you don't know. And, you know, I would imagine there'll be a lot of people queuing up now and thinking, well, maybe I can bring this allegation as well, which, of course, you know, could open the floodgates, really. You know, he did have a reputation, did he not, back in the day? They called him, Randy Andy.
Yes.
And so, you know, and I know, not that Prince Andrew, by the way, is a predator. I'm not saying that, neither should we. But, you know, generally predators will have a long list of victims. So, the possibility is that there will be others that will come forward now. The other issue, by the way, Mark, of course, is what's the police as well? We've talked about this before. Mm. You know, Virginia Giuffre did go to the Metropolitan Police in 2015. She made a statement. They said that there wasn't a case to answer. It was for the Americans to deal with. They reviewed that again in 19. They reviewed that again in 21. And they made the same judgment that there's no case to answer. They left the FBI. The FBI said, we are keen to investigate. We would like to speak to Prince Andrew. He said he was cooperating. He never did. So that remains extant. You know, the potential police investigation, which is completely separate to this civil matter, remains open. And whether or not people will just close the door and say, right, it's been dealt with, is one thing. But of course, it never was dealt with in this country.
Yeah, and that's the massive problem. I mean, we will go on and talk shortly with regards to the resignation of the Commissioner of Metropolitan Police. But this goes back again to her door. There is a situation, of course, where they're saying there isn't evidence enough to consider and to pursue an investigation. Now, what we don't know is what they have done to make that decision, whether they've simply done what's called a scoping exercise. But it kind of has similarities with the whole issue of Partygate. We've got the Metropolitan Police who said there isn't enough evidence to investigate. Sue Gray, individual who doesn't have any policing investigative experience, does her investigation. shares her report with the police, who then go, oh, well, there is evidence to investigate. They start investigating. So what will it take? Does it take somebody else to come along and say, actually, there is evidence to investigate. Here we are, Metropolitan Police, start investigating it.
Apparently, it's
a shocking position, really. The Metropolitan Police, given the nature of the allegations and given the fact that they obviously have credibility, they've been tested to a degree, certainly by public opinion, but to a degree in court as well. They cannot even start an investigation. And we're not talking about them ultimately making a decision or the Crown Prosecution Service making a decision and charge. What we're saying is that there should be enough of an investigation for a case file to be put together for the Crown Prosecution Service to consider.
Exactly,
they will not do that.
No, they haven't. I mean, they've been reluctant to do so. It leaves that impression. It's really quite extraordinary. We call this podcast Fear or Favour, and we thought people may not understand that. But that's been the language that's been used nonstop now by the police. They've been talking about, oh, no, hang on a minute. We operate without fear or favour. We're going to investigate. We are considering without fear or favour. So maybe we've added something to the national discourse. But I think that's a really important point, is that the police have been forced, literally forced, to investigate Partygate. They've never intended to do so, and they did so at the last minute for all the reasons that we know and we discussed before. And they, you know, in relation to allegations against Prince Andrew, they look like now everything has been done for them as to if whether or not they want to investigate or not is entirely up to them. But again, they've been forced into even considering the issue. And that again leads to this impression, does it not, that there's one rule for some people and another rule for others.
Yeah, I think I also want to talk briefly about Virginia Dufresne. And I think it's really important that we put to bed some of the perhaps rumours or concerns that people have. And this is obviously only our view. My view very clearly is that this poor lady has been through hell. You know, she has faced the media on a worldwide stage, giving up very personal information, not just in relation to what happened to her, but because of the way that the whole process works. A lot of information came out over the trial of Maxwell and through the media. And as we discussed at the beginning, the whole civil process is around, you know, a financial settlement at the end. And she was about to face the stage again. And the toll on her, I can't begin to imagine what that has been. No. And therefore, to be in a position where you can settle out of court, you can also be in a position, whilst he doesn't admit it, because he was never going to admit it in court, the public opinion is one of, well, you don't pay 12 million if you haven't done it. And I think that we have to weigh it all up and think, do you know what? This poor lady has suffered intolerably in terms of what's taken place. And for her now, it is a position to say, I've got some closure. I know what he did. The public opinion know what he did. I now have to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was immensely courageous. I mean, I don't know how many of us would have to. You know, we know from our own experience how much it takes for anybody that's alleging sexual offences to come forward, to stay with the investigation, to ultimately go into a courtroom or potentially do so. That's why we have such a low conviction rate. It's only 1% in this country or thereabouts. So, the point is, it took enormous energy from her and courage from her, and whether she, she's decided to give whatever money that she gets to victims charities that she's working with, and that again sends out a really strong message. I think one of the things I tried to make out in the last two or three days, actually, Mark, was that since we learned of the settlement, is the impact on the wider victim community of this case. Time and time again, they are blamed for their behavior. Time and time again, they're told that they're money grabbing, or that they are making things up, or they have false memories. You heard that one as well.
Yeah.
And so I have no doubt that this prolonged battle, if that's the right phrase, has had an impact on victim confidence. And I hope now, at least, they can see, even if it isn't the outcome that perhaps Dufresne wanted, and maybe other victims could want it, it gives them the hope that actually they will be listened to and they'll be believed. And that's really important.
I think that's absolutely right. And if you go back to the work that we did, you know, Savile, the Rochdale, all of that process created a real buzz and a real positivity around the victim community, where they felt that they were, for the very first time, being properly listened to, being investigated. those allegations taken seriously. They then went through a slight change, and the pendulum very rarely sits in the middle, where the police went and made some really seriously erred in terms of their arrests, in terms of who they investigated. And that knocked the victim community thinking, well, hang on a minute, we're now being accused of making stuff up, you know, false memory, lies and so on. And so I think this whole process on a worldwide stage has been really beneficial for the victim community to start to try and level that back up again, to say, do you know what? We are taking these matters seriously and we will pursue them to the end. And in fact, we've talked a number of times here, is that the Americans, I think, have done a great job here. The British couldn't even be bothered to do an investigation over their very person who sits at the top. And as you say, fear or favour, they've absolutely not done that. They've shown absolute favour in terms of Prince Andrew.
No, 100%. Let's talk about Ghislaine Maxwell, because there's been they are linked in many respects. As we all know, she was convicted by the New York jury. She's awaiting sentence. The discourse in the immediate aftermath of the jury finding was this jury was contaminated in some way, because a couple of jurors, American jurors, can speak up publicly, talked about their previous allegations, previously having been sexually abused. And so the view was that perhaps these individuals shouldn't have been on the jury. That's what we were hearing. It was reported widely. People were saying, how could she, you know, maybe she didn't get a fair trial, et cetera, et cetera. We then see this week the defense argument in relation to a retrial. And that's quite astounding, actually, Mark. No mention of jury. None at all. Even though they've allowed, the defense team have allowed the last month or so to be all about the jury being flawed and contaminated in some way, to get some sympathy for Ghislaine Maxwell, in effect. When it comes to the actual legal argument, which the judge was, in effect, allowed to be made public, not one mention of the jury. It's all about some legal issues, some very technical issues. Should the judge have allowed three conspiracies to be heard by the jury or rather than one? You know, that's our listeners don't need to be too concerned about that. What's most important is, in my mind, is that we've all been we've been given whatever the comfortable phrase, you know, we've been told it's all about the jury. It's all about the jury. Yeah. When actually, it's never been about the jury. And that, I think, really gives us another view as to what's going on here, is that we're being played. Yeah, we're literally being played.
Isn't that the case with so many cases? And when I look back on my work around Oscar Pistorius and some of the information that was being fed into the media by the police, and in particular the officer leading it at the very beginning, saying, you know, he was on performance-enhancing drugs, she was pregnant. So some of this stuff that was being fed was absolutely not true. And I think the problem we massively have is the impartiality and the balance of the media in the way that things are reported, but also the honesty of those people who are feeding it into the media. There are people, of course, who will always have a vested interest in one side or the other and are very happy for misinformation, lies, to be put into the media if they see it benefits them.
I think it's important about benefit is that by thinking, for example, about the jury being in some way flawed or contaminated, you're left, or they want to leave this impression that you should be sympathetic to Ghislaine Maxwell. Yeah. But had they focused on what they are actually focusing on, which is some legal technicalities, probably wouldn't have given a proverbial about whether or not she's got a fair trial. So there would have been no sympathy attached to Ghislaine Maxwell. So they've deliberately carved out a route which was to try and present her as the victim, in effect, of a justice system that's flawed. But in actual fact, it is just some legal issues that judges would need to address at some point, or may have addressed in a certain way. And I think, the very valid point is that we're often the victims of PR rather than the facts. And what we hope we can do during our conversations is stick to the facts.
I do think Ghislaine Maxwell has received far softer media coverage, criticism, than the case would have attracted had she been a man. And I do think that that is a very important thing for us to consider. You know, is that what is it that makes us think that we should give an easier time to females, or that they should have an easier time? They are, and I've done this so many times, I've investigated, as have you, many female offenders. And what stands out for me, the difference between them very often, is actually the callousness of it. In terms of child abuse, they will often carry out far more the manner in which they carry it out is often far greater than most of the men, certainly in terms of dealing with. But we do give them, the press gives them, such an easy ride at times.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with you on this. I mean, we look back in history, Myra Henley and Ian Brady, horrible things that they did.
Fred and Rose West.
Fred and Rose West, exactly. So we know there's a history. I think it's just what clicks is clickbait, isn't it? What do the newspapers get interested in? They get interested in pictures of women, unfortunately, regrettably, and pretty faces, or however they want to present it. That's what they choose to do. We've got to ensure that everybody gets a fair trial. We've got to ensure that everybody's treated in the same way. You know, the whole point of equality, you know, justice is meant to be blind. You know, we shouldn't be looking at gender or color or anything of that nature. But human nature is such, and we often think, well, we can understand a man doing this, but a woman, you know, that's a sort of almost like an innate response that we have in our minds. And I think that's something we've just got to be mindful of. When we look at these types of things, that we mustn't treat people differently just because of their gender or their sex. And I think, we're going to talk a moment about the next commissioner, or the current commissioner of the police. And people were thinking, it's like having a mother in charge of the organization. Surely that will fix the organization. Well, we now know that's not exactly the case.
And just finishing on Maxwell, I don't see her defense, the defense's team appeal, being successful in any way at all, do you?
No, I don't. It's legal technicalities. At the end of the day, the jury listened to the facts, and they were the judges of facts and came to the conclusion that they did. So I don't think it'll change anything.
So a very significant development. We have the largest police force in the country by the Metropolitan Police, which has had a female commissioner for some time now. You know, she's into 40 years of policing, and over her term, she has been involved in an awful lot of very high profile cases. And in fact, when she took on the role, I think there was real positivity that existed within rank and file, saying this is a great person to take over. The Metropolitan Police has, of course, lived through the horrific misogyny that existed, certainly in the 70s and 80s, not just in the Mets, but across police forcing in whole. It's addressed issues of having predominance over male, and to particularly in certain ranks and in certain departments where there is great and far greater balance. And I talk in particular around CID. I was at a CID conference talking actually just before lockdown, and I gave a talk, and I was sat on the table with a lot of senior officers. And one of the things that we talked about was it was great to see that balance now properly existing within CID, which was traditionally very much a male bastion society. And so that's brilliant. But what we have now, of course, got is a position where the confidence within the Metropolitan Police over recent events has massively taken a hit. And I know that by talking to other colleagues who are in the Metropolitan Police of just how difficult it is for them to do their job. But we have kind of had a fight between two very key politicians. We've got one hand, the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who has been incredibly supportive of the commissioner, so much so that she said, and perhaps we'll explore that this year, but she's been very clear in to say that she felt that there wasn't someone who was suitable to replace her, and therefore gave her the extension to her tenure. And then, of course, we've had the London Mayor, Sadiq Khan, who has been very critical openly about her position and has said that basically she's under watch and I'm not very happy about that process. Ultimately, that resulted in the commissioner saying, well, if I don't have the confidence of the London mayor, then I don't believe I've got the confidence to carry on in this role. And she offered her resignation.
Well, that's what we think. I mean,
that's how it's played out in the public.
More has been coming out of the last 24 hours, day or so, actually, which may add a little bit more color to this. Yeah, I know for a fact. I mean, I won't disclose my sources, but in August of last year, the Home Secretary was not keen on extending her contract. You know, it was a 5-year contract, and she indicated to certain individuals that that was not going to be extended. And then about a month later, it was. And whether or not the Prime Minister was involved in that decision or not, I don't know. But in any event, the extension happened.
And but she did come out and say that she offers that full support, and there is nobody.
She's been publicly, she's been immensely supportive, and remains so. Well, whether we know remains so is a different story. The mayor, strangely, was also immensely supportive, and he until the last month, he's been, you know, always talking about how much confidence he has, despite all the various crises, whether it's the Sarah Everard murder, whether it was the way certain things were policed, the Alistair Morgan report. So the Daniel Morgan report, the corruption that led to that murder investigation, the Charing Cross police station report, which found a culture of racism, misogyny, homophobia, and disablism in that particular police station. All of these various things were lining up to present a very different picture of Metropolitan Police to the public, and that was important. And I think at the end there, the Charing Cross report, which we've talked about before, that was probably the main thing did for her. That's when I think I know for a fact, the mayor then told her that you used the word she's on notice in effect, and there was a meeting arranged which she decided not to turn up to, and that's when she offered her resignation. I think those are the facts. We've learned subsequently that there's another report due imminently. We haven't touched on this case before in any detail, but Daniel Morgan murder.
I think we should definitely do.
I think we'll do it in a future podcast. And I think it's important to do that because all that people need to know right now is that there was a report in relation to this murder that took place more than 25 years ago, which found institutional corruption in the Metropolitan Police. It criticized the current commissioner or former commissioner herself by saying that she had been delaying the delivery of some paperwork that the inquiry needed to see. But there is now another report, which what happened in the immediate aftermath of that report, the Home Secretary and the Mayor asked Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary to look at whether or not this was looking back 25 years. What's happening now? In terms of the institutional corruption, et cetera, et cetera. And that, I think, we're led to believe a draft of that landed in the Home Office and in the Mayor's office about a week ago. And it is, by all accounts, damning. Yeah. It hasn't been published yet and won't be shortly. Well, maybe, may not be at all, but I don't know. It will be, but in some form anyway. And so things aren't getting better. And it might, some people are saying it might explain why the commissioner simply said, right, okay, I'll just resign, rather than have another battle when this report is published,
But it's more than that, isn't it? Because you're absolutely right. There's one more report to come, but it's only a matter of time before there's another report and there's another report and there's another issue that comes up. And of course, the pressure is immense. Let's go back, though, slightly. Let's look at the whole process of why she has got to this position. So she is the leader. She's in charge of the Metropolitan Police, but she can't be held accountable for the actions of all those people within the force. But when we look at policing as a whole, where do you think policing needs to go? How do we make these changes? Because there is an endemic element of policing, which I think is racist, because that's how policing was born, and that's how, not just racist, but also sexist, because it was traditionally a male environment. What do we do that starts to go back to some of those early elements and says, right, well, let's address those major issues, and how do we start to tackle them?
The answer is relatively straightforward, actually. We're coming up to the 200th anniversary of the creation of the Metropolitan Police. So 2029 is the 200th anniversary, Robert Peel, and you can go and look through your history books. And there's an opportunity here for the government, of any government, to say, right, we're going to have a Royal Commission, which is, take evidence and so stop tinkering. We get a lot of tinkering yes. with how policing operates. Here's a new law. We have criminal justice laws every year.
It's a plaster, isn't it?
Literally, plaster. A bit of process here, a new guide, a bit of guidance there. We're just messing with it rather than actually let's have a look at whether the policing model we have now is fit for the 21st century. Little things that always irk me, actually, Mark, is that to become a chief constable or the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, you have to be a current deputy or a current assistant commissioner. That means there are potentially 45, maybe 50 people that can apply for 43 jobs.
Yeah.
You know, can you think of anything else where there's only 50 people in the whole country that can do 43 jobs? I mean, so the pool in which you are getting the talent from is really, really small. If you remember, maybe our listeners will, a few years ago there was talk about opening up to Americans and Australians and other Commonwealth jurisdictions.
And it's been talked about now, hasn't it?
You know, yeah, it is, absolutely.
I read some newspapers saying some Australian person.
Yeah, but we won't make that leap. You know, we talk about it, but we won't make that leap. But the problem, of course, is because of this small pool. No disrespect to the 50 people or so on the pool, but you know, generally when you're applying, when you're trying to find a new person, you're looking at the hundreds of people to see where you can find this talented person. But if you if you're fishing in a small pool, you're going to get whatever you're going to get. And so I think that's a key problem. I think maybe the force structure, 43 forces, Warwickshire Police, which is the smallest force, 150 of, I don't know how small it is these days. You know, we learned from previous experience that small forces are perhaps unsustainable.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was talk, wasn't there, in the immediate aftermath of the Soham murders, when we discovered that Cambridgeshire Police couldn't deal with a multiple homicide case, people were coming in from other forces. Maybe, you know, we shouldn't just be wedded to this idea of 43 forces. Maybe we just need nine or 11.
Some of those forces have addressed that. You know, my former force, Surrey and Sussex, have joined up on the major crime team. And you can see that on some of the other.
It's tinkering again, courses. Isn't it? It's tinkering. But it is rather than thinking about it from a governance perspective, how it really ought to change. We're just working within the rules we have at the moment.
But we go back to, I mean, it's David Blunkett years, when David Blunkett was very clear saying, you know, we need to get rid of 43 police forces. We need to have a structured system. And I'm absolutely for that. I believe and have said for a very long time that we need national and regional police forces. Because there are certain things can be dealt with on a very different level. And I think that if it works, it can work really well. But I just think we've got to a position now where we need local policing. Local policing is really, really important. So I'm reluctant to have larger police forces covering larger areas, because what that does is it reduces, in my mind, the local policing. What I would like to see is much more focus on low, middle, and high, and by having that, you've got a national and regional forces.
I think that's the right structure. Neighborhood policing, local policing is the bedrock. Should be the bedrock of policing. But you know what happens after that in terms of the senior management, in terms of the middle management, in the way that things are operating. And you know, the Metropolitan Police is a monster. I mean, not in a negative way. Why? Here's the question. Why is counterterrorism a Metropolitan Police responsibility? Why can't you take that off, give it to the National Crime Agency or a separate police force dealing with that? Mm. You know, if you have all of these roles added on, that's probably why the Met job is so difficult or virtually impossible, given we've only had one Met commissioner in the last five that's had to sort out their whole term.
But does this go back to the days, you know, you go back to train robbery, go back to some of those early days of policing. One of the things that was always occurring, if a crime happened in a provincial area, it would very often say, well, we're calling the New Scotland Yard. We've called in New Scotland Yard. And I think that probably still has some kind of relevance now, where people traditionally, I mean, if you go abroad, very often you tell people you're in the police and say, oh, New Scotland Yard.
Exactly. It is well famous.
And I think this is its attitude still, is that the Metropolitan Police are the best, the creme of everything. Well, policing has changed so much now, and actually all police forces have got some amazing police officers. And I think you're right. If you take terrorism, which is obviously the highest level of policing financial commitment in any policing level, and you put that to the test, and you say, well, okay, well, why is it then that the Metropolitan Police are the lead in that? That shouldn't be the case. All these police forces should be working together.
They don't want to give it up because the budget comes with it, the kudos comes with
Absolutely.
It, esteem yeah. comes with it. But we shouldn't be thinking about those things. How do we make the Met's job, policing jobs, more manageable? Horses for courses. Set up your own units. The National Crime Agency does brilliant work, by the way. I've been absolutely impressed by them. They're the equivalent of our FBI, but they don't have anything like the powers of the FBI.
And very well led. I mean,
very well led, absolutely.
She's very good.
So let's give them more power. Let's give them more responsibility and share out some of this workload in a way that currently isn't being done, which I think would make the Metropolitan Police job more manageable. Maybe not so attractive to some of the people that want it, but at the end of the day, we shouldn't be caring about that. It's about what the citizen gets and what the citizen needs.
And I think that's absolutely right. And I think the National Crime Agency is absolutely the right place for far more national level policing to take place. That's what they are. They're a national police force, but they're not being allowed to do the job.
Kicking and screaming. Everything that's been given to the NCA has been given to them with forces kicking and screaming. Don't give it to them. We need to keep this. And that sort of conflict and those kinds of tensions are just not fit for where we are right now.
It's an elitism that's very senior level of the Metropolitan Police. And I say that candidly, there are a number of very senior commissioning level officers in the Metropolitan Police who I know very well. And I think those have come into it fairly recently, who I think are very, very good at the job. But they're coming into an organisation of which this elitism already exists.
Yep.
And what we know with elitism is it fractures and it creates real problems for those other people doing the job.
Yeah, absolutely. People... Too much focus on the pips on your shoulder, too much focus on the on what it means for you, potentially also what it means for your future roles. I mean, how many former commissioners end up either being in the Lords, House of Lords, or having international roles? It's a big thing. I get that. I understand that. But I think at the end of the day, it should be about what the citizen wants, what the citizen needs. It's about what general police officers want. We've been talking about them or ignoring them. Morale is really low. I think I mentioned last time. Whenever I run into them, they hate the fact that people are talking in negative terms about policing in ways that they never did before. And so we've got to ensure that morale is boosted. We've got to ensure that the general police officer feels that this is the right job and that they are being properly supported. But at the end of the day, leadership matters.
Absolutely. I mean, don't forget, policing in this country we police by consent. Yeah. So it is the public who are the eyes and ears of the police. And we need the public to consent to being policed, because otherwise it all goes absolutely wrong. We end up in a totalitarian state where we have many other countries operate in that fashion, where it's politically driven. And what we need, you're absolutely right, time has come for the Home Secretary, the Prime Minister to say, let's look at policing. Let's go right back. Let's get a Royal Commission on policing. And let's, for the very first time, take it apart and see where we are. Because these problems that exist in the Metropolitan Police, whilst it's the biggest, they also exist in the other police forces.
Yes.
They're just less under the microscope. They're carried out on a far smaller scale than they are within the Metropolitan Police.
Mark, you have no idea. Some of these, maybe you don't, because I get these messages from other officers in other parts of the country, and they're always going, phew, thank God nobody's looking at us.
It's the same. I mean, I talk to police officers up and down the country. It's my work. I day-to-day talk to police officers, and some of the things that are happening in other police forces just get hidden. These police officers saying, if only they knew this, or if they only knew that. But also one has to weigh that up. We have to have the confidence in the police to do their job. And we can't have the confidence in the police to do their job if every minute of the day they're in the news themselves making their own story for the failings that they've done.
Yeah, I know. Confidence comes from competence. If people don't think that you're competent in your job, why would they possibly have confidence in you?
Well, listen... Another amazing conversation. We can sit and talk about these things forever, and I'm sure that the public will have some views. If you are listening to this, please do come back to us with any of your thoughts around this whole case. We read every single email that comes in and we respond to them. Thank you for listening to Feel Favored. Do please tell your friends, your colleagues, subscribe to our channel. Tell everybody, whether they're in this country or the other countries, please listen, because it is really important, I think. And we do get to the heart of these cases. Next week, we're going to look at some of the issues around Caroline Flack and the CPS decision and the DPP's involvement in that case. And that's, of course, raised its head quite considerably with Caroline Flack's mum talking. We're also going to look at diplomatic immunity. This is one of the questions that a number of people have asked us, to look at the Harry Dunn and Askoulas case because of the involvement of the diplomatic immunity. And we're going to talk in brief terms around some of the issues around Djokovic. I think this is something that is really interesting around the whole aspects of the ministerial involvement. And of course, Djokovic now very clearly saying that, well, I won't be able to play some of these tournaments then because I'm not going to be forced to have the jab. Nazir, loads and loads going on to talk about. I wish you a great week as ever. You've got a lot of writing to do this week.
Yeah, I've got to finish my second book and deliver the manuscript and, lots of late nights and early mornings, I'm afraid.
Well, it's all worth it in the end.
I hope so.
Thanks for listening, and we shall see you next week. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.